Finance will come to order. Senator Hoffman, Dyson, Stedman, Co-Chair Wilken, and myself, Senator Green, have some bills on the docket this morning. We're joined by Senator Olson as well. And Senator Wilken, do you have anything to report or announce?
No, ma'am. I don't. Thank you for asking. Not right now.
Think of anything before the end of the meeting. We'll get that on the
Think of anything?
If you think. Oh, yeah, that's okay. Anyway, first item today is Senate Bill 133, the Aviation Advisory Board, which is on the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Nona, are you going to be presenting? And I see Kip Knudsen came in. Would you like to come to the table as well, Kip? Make your compelling case.
Madam Chair, for the record, Kip Knudsen, State Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And I'm going to let the brains speak before beauty.
Okay.
Right. Oh, good.
Good morning.
I know.
Nona Wilson, Alaska DOT. In the interest of time, I'll just go through a brief statement, and then we also have a sectional in the packet if you wanted to buzz through that. I know you have some other bills to hear today. Madam Chair, the bill before you is one that the Department of Transportation sees as critical to the state's aviation infrastructure, as well as Alaska's aviation industry as a whole. The Aviation Advisory Board was originally created in January of 2003 by Admin Order Number 204, and to avoid dissolution, the board was renewed in June of 2004 through Admin Order 215. This bill would continue the existence of the board without the need for annual administrative renewals. And we feel that with two international hubs in Anchorage and Fairbanks, as well as 258 rural airports across the state, a permanent board is practical and necessary to the continued success and prudent operation of the state's airports. The Aviation Advisory Board serves not only as an advisory committee to the commissioner, it facilitates continuous dialogue and ongoing coordination between the state and aviation industry on matters of aviation policy, safety, airport management, and operations. And as you can see on page 2 of the bill, board membership represents a broad cross-section of Alaska's aviation industry, which promotes well-balanced dialogue and, as a whole, serves as a valuable combination of expertise. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll be happy to address any comments, or Kip as well, or questions you might have.
Are there any questions from members of the board? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As we look at this new board that's coming on, who is making the decisions, or what function are they going to be doing that wasn't done in the past?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, this is the reason that the advisory board was formed, actually, because there was not a very good conduit between the aviation interest groups and the people running the airport system. And there was a lot of frustration in the aviation community about that poor communication. So the advisory board, if nothing else, has provided a good conduit for all of these alphabet groups and communities to communicate directly with DOT about their concerns and issues.
I could continue, Madam Chairman. As I look at the composition of the board, though, I see almost a majority of the board is not necessarily aviation related. Number 5, number 6, number 7.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the governor thought when he first formed it through his administrative order that didn't want to predetermine that they had to be aviation people, but effectively they are all aviation people. There's nobody on there doesn't have some leg in the aviation industry or some aviation interest group. So I think effectively what happens is the two mayors were allowed from Fairbanks and from Anchorage were allowed to appoint people. And Richard Ween is appointed for Fairbanks, and Wilbur O'Brien, former president of Air Aviation, was appointed from Anchorage. So just it happens that they're all aviation interested.
So the logical conclusion is you would assume that they're going to have a knowledge of the aviation industry and follow from there. And is the listing of the composition of the board somewhat consistent with the original administrative order? Or have they kind of morphed into
I'm sure it's identical, except it adds one at-large member for tie breaks. Currently, the membership is 10.
Oh, okay, okay. Very good. And has the board met fairly consistently in the 2 years that it's been?
Yes, Madam Chair, much to the chagrin of the members, perhaps, I think we've met 9 times in the last 2 years. So they've had a very busy schedule.
Now, we could allow the governor to continue to issue administrative orders and have this board in operation. This simply puts it into statute and brings it under review through our ledge budget and audit and process, and keeps it more in line with other boards in the state. Are there any other questions? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. What are some of the major issues that the board has addressed and resolved during the last 2 years?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, they have spent quite a bit of time discussing airport governance. You know, DOT runs Anchorage and Fairbanks, but Ketchikan runs their airport, Juneau runs their airport. So they were trying to assess what the best way is for airports to be governed, whether DOT is a good manager of airports. Spent a lot of time getting information from around the country about airport authorities, trying to figure out if we're running the airports in the most cost-effective way. They've also addressed some FAA issues, the King Salmon Tower, and they're just now getting into the debate of how small is too small, how small a community can support a $10 million airport. So they're grappling with some big issues, and they've given some very good advice, and they've helped the commissioner in ways of allocation of resources, et cetera.
Answer your question. Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, a couple of questions. I guess I'm concerned about the size of the board. And I could make changes, but I'm not so hard over that I would do that. But I look at the size, and I look at the responsibility, and then I look at the budget, and they just don't seem to be in alignment. And then I look at the language on page 1, section .220, meetings, hearings, and records, and it doesn't seem to set forth the ability to be able to meet and make decisions by teleconference. So what this tells me is that 11 people are going to meet 2, 3, 4 times a year, most likely in Anchorage or Fairbanks, and they're going to do it for $20,000. So first thing then, is it expected for the record that they would be able to meet and decide meetings by teleconference?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, they have actually had teleconferences in the past 2 years. They probably would like face-to-face before they issued resolutions. I think that happens to be their personal preference, the current members. And we've had meetings in Fairbanks, Anchorage, Ketchikan, and Juneau so far.
Will they be constrained then by the $20,000 available for them to spend every year?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, I think $20,000 we'll have to scrimp, but we'll make it work.
Okay. Then the second question has to do with page 3, line 2. It seems odd that the governor would designate the chairman or chairperson of the board. I would like some discussion on that, and I'm almost moved to delete that particular provision. It seems to me that a board of 11 with the important decisions that they'll make, that they would be perfectly able to choose their own chairman, and I think that just keeps peace in the family. Any discussion or thought about that? We don't seem to do that in other boards, that's why I'm wondering.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, I believe that must be a construct of some boards. It was recommended by the Aviation Advisory Board, oddly enough, that be included in the administrative order, and that also came up during the governor's transition process. Richard Ween specifically thought that was a better idea, depoliticized the chair to a certain extent, didn't make it a popularity contest, it just said, he's the chair, he's going to run your meetings.
Madam Chair, is it your intent to move this out today?
If you don't want me to, I'll hold it.
Well, let's do this. I would move conceptual amendment number 1, page 3, line 2, paragraph C, that starting with the words "the governor" and ending on line three with the words "governor's request, comma," those words be stricken, and the sentence would then read paragraph C, "the board shall elect a chair from among its members who are not state officers or employees."
And I'll object to the amendment. And speaking of my objection, one of the things that does happen sometimes in some boards, although this has a little bit of a head start under the advisory order, is that you have a board that's ready to start from the beginning, and you don't have a delay in ratcheting up to get to the point where you can conduct business. And in my somewhat limited experiences with boards, there have been many times I've thought the things would have been much more efficient if the arrangement of the executive, the board chair, could have been changed by the governor, would have been much more preferable than waiting to enough members get well enough acquainted with the issues to be able to understand that they need a new board chair. And so I would move to legal language, but we certainly have the amendment before us. Is there any other discussion? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is the to Senator Wilkin. Why are you not striking the portion that talks about excluding state officers and employees? I guess the reason I say that is because you got some state officers out there and employees that are very knowledgeable about the aviation industry and certainly would be a benefit and in some places would be an ideal chair. But if they're automatically excluded, then all of a sudden you're down to lists that are there.
I don't think the state officer or the employees should be chairs of the commission. It's a citizen commission to me. Madam Chair? That move and ask unanimous consent that I be allowed to withdraw conceptual motion number one.
Is there objection to join with amendment number one? Amendment number one is withdrawn. Is there any other items that anyone has questions about? Senator Olson?
I don't have any questions. I just want to make sure that it's clear that my position is that this advisory board is certainly an asset to the aviation industry, having been an operator of two air taxi. I know that these people are certainly head and shoulders in the community, in the industry, and I speak strongly in favor of this bill.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll hold this over till tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Bill 150, Children's Trust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Jason Hooley, staff of Senator Dyson. Senate Bill 150 is sponsored by the Senate Hess Committee by the request of the Alaska Children's Trust Board of Trustees. Back in the late 80s, the trust was installed with the intention to help fund startup costs for programs that aim to combat child abuse. And in the administration of that program, the trustees are seeking additional flexibility in determining the grants that they award. And in response to that, Senate Bill 150 does a few things, and they are, Section 1 requires applicants for grants to include self-sustainability plans in their proposals. Section 2 of the bill removes the current $50,000 cap on annual grant awards. This section also refines the funding formula and sets a four-year limit on grant awards to reinforce that this trust account is to be used as seed money for these programs. Section 3 allows the board to enforce its requirements with the authority to reduce or discontinue grants based on the performance of the grantees. That's all, Madam Chair.
And why are we having to redo this, Jason? We just did this about 5 or 6 years ago and kind of set the parameters. What happened that we need to change this?
Madam Chair, I'd like to direct that question to Margot McCabe, the chair of the Children's Trust, who I hope is online.
She is.
Hi, this is Margot McCabe, the chair of the Alaska Children's Trust. In answer to your question, as you know, the current assets of the fund now exceed $10 million, but the trust is only allowed to spend the net income earned by the fund every year to fund child abuse programs around the state. Over the past couple years, we've only had enough money to fund recurring grants. And so the intent of this legislation is to limit funding for those grants so that monies are available for new innovative programs that help solve this problem.
And what is there in current language that needs to be changed? Why are we changing the 100%, 75, 50, and 25? What happened?
In terms of the funding formula itself?
Yes.
I think, again, it basically sets the stage for our grantees to become self-sustaining after the four-year period. It basically is the thinking that if you reduce the grant award every year, you know, they're becoming slowly more and more self-sufficient. And again, it frees up more money, at least in the early years, to fund other programs.
Okay. How many people have been awarded the full $50,000?
Well, actually, the last RFP, I believe, limited the maximum grant to $30,000.
Okay.
And I think about half of them originally applied for that amount.
And originally what?
Applied for that amount.
Okay.
I can tell you... the current grant awards, there were four that received the maximum amount of $30,000 in the last round.
Okay.
We're just about to issue a new RFP this month.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go through a whole new cycle.
Yeah, I was just kind of interested in the $50,000 because the current statute limits the amount of grants to $50,000. I was just curious how many had reached that grant amount, but you don't have that figure before you?
I don't. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Those were awarded before my time on the board, but I believe there were approximately, if I'm doing the math right, in the last cycle, four of them applied for the maximum grant award.
Okay. Very good. Commissioner Gilbertson, could you join us, please? Go ahead and introduce yourself. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joel Gilbertson, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
And when we were in Senate Hess, we had a discussion on the language change needed and a specific reason for that, and I want to be sure we get that on the record.
Sure.
Could you kind of review that for us, please?
Right, and following up on the question that the chair asked, if I was following it correctly, is what really is the need for the formula change going into Section 2? And one of the key elements in here is an actual cap on total years of funding at four. The current language that's in the statute authorizing the Alaska Children's Trust leaves it essentially with no guidance as to how long grants can continue. There's a formula for stepping down the grant amounts, but once you reach that last rung, it can last into perpetuity. In fact, as I was looking at the list of current grantees, we have one grantee who's in their eighth year of funding. And without this sort of natural revolving list of grants that we're funding, and with a finite amount of resources for the grants, we've ended up in the situation we are in right now, where no grants are transitioning off, and so there's no funding for grants to transition on. So for the last 2 years, we have not issued a new grant, and rather all the money has gone towards continuation funding for existing programs. And this will continue on into perpetuity because we're not expecting great change in the amount of earnings the fund's realizing right now. So really, this provision, first and foremost, allows us to do grant making for the first time in almost 2 years. Right now, we're just doing continuation funding.
And I, being at the table when that previous legislation was written, it was intended to have an end certain, and somehow that language, you know, wasn't clear enough, and this corrects what was done at the table and says you get a percentage the first year, a reduced percentage the second, third, and fourth year, and then it's over, so that there are opportunities for new organizations to come on and have a boost but not a lifelong support system.
Madam Chair, when looking at the existing language for the Children's Trust, it's clear that there is that there was an intent to have the grants move towards sustainability plans and to transition off after a four-year cycle. But right now, the operating sentence that says grants are limited to 4 years is missing in statute, so this would correct that.
Mm-hmm. With the change in the this doesn't actually change the cap. Oh, it reduces the cap, right? I mean, it eliminates the cap.
Madam Chair, my understanding is after this section is adopted and signed into law, it would eliminate the cap on Children's Trust grants. They would always naturally be capped by the resources available, of course.
That's what I was going to get to, because you're not going to have suddenly give one person 100% of the money. And
based on this formula, acknowledging that there are grants that have already been approved that would go through this four-year cycling mm-hmm. of off, then you also have the actual earnings that come in from the trust, it's physically impossible for a grantee to take the entire amount.
Well, is it your opinion that currently, so once someone is on the grant line there, it's very difficult for any reason that they fall off currently?
Madam Chair, what I've seen, if I can talk at maybe at a level even above the Children's Trust, I work on with a number of organizations, with the Denali Commission, with other entities too. One of the things you constantly see is that areas that are probably most in need of the programs and programs that are most in need of coming into their communities are often those that are least prepared to submit a good grant application. Mm-hmm. Many times organizations that can submit the best grant applications tend to be areas that are resourced enough. Mm-hmm. And so how do we attract into those communities where they maybe don't have a grant writer, or you go to these communities, particularly in some of the rural regions, where they simply don't have the resources to compete with some of the larger organizations? How do we make them competitive? I think that this structure allows for sort of a natural transition, the development of sustainability plans, the trust working at the front end in developing sustainability plans and performance measures and high grading the applications that come in. But also allowing a natural transition process gets some individuals who probably were on the periphery now into the system and at least being able to get some startup funding. The existing programs, many of them are good programs. They're not doing bad work. It's just that if the state is going to continue through the Children's Trust to fund these grants at that 25% and never expect them to become fully self-sustaining, what does that initial language saying you need to become sustaining really mean then? And also, how do we ever get to the point where we build up other organizations and allow some who've matured to move on their own without state support?
And in Section 3, where we talk about the continuance or reduction of a grant, do you currently have that provision in law?
The Section 3 language is new language, Madam Chair. So currently there is no requirement that we discontinue grants that are not meeting performance measures. Naturally, there's an annual RFP process that goes out. The applications come in. We are collecting data on these grants. I must say, when I first joined the trust, I was a little disappointed with some of the performance measures that were being used, some of the outcome data that was being collected. Trustees have taken a passion around this as well, and I know that the RFP that's going out now is for this upcoming year is looking more towards outcome data, and that needs to drive our decision-making into the out years. But no, this would be new language, and this would solidify the trust's authority to discontinue grants if they're not meeting the outcome measures that were agreed to at the beginning of the RFP.
And that's certainly more in keeping with what that organization, the Children's Trust, should be doing, and gives you oversight and kind of an ability to check and double check on organizations that are receiving grants.
Madam Chair, talking with the trustees on the Children's Trust, I think that they are in agreement across the trustees that we really have to have a better tool and a better reason for why we approve a grant or why we discontinue a grant. And having that outcome data moves us into an area where we can acknowledge, is this grantee performing? Is the state getting the best outcome for the resources that are being invested? And what are some new proposals that are on the table if we decide to move our dollars in a different direction? And so this really starts to solidify a framework into perpetuity within the trust, that we're looking at that outcome data. I think it's very similar to missions and measures the legislature adopts. But this is, what are we using to drive our decision-making, and how are we making sure that that investment is continuing to deliver good results for the state?
Are there any other questions for the commissioner or Jason? Margo, do you have anything else you would like to add?
No, in the interest of time, I think everything that we've needed to say has been presented today. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us today. We appreciate that. Is there any anyone who want to hold this over, or is it okay for us to go ahead and pass this out today? Okay, Senator Wilkin, could we get a motion on that, please?
Madam Chair, I move to report Senate Bill 150 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Thank you. Is there objection? There being no objection, Senate Bill 150 passes out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please. Eddies, please. We can meet on that. Senate Bill 133, Aviation Advisory Board. Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, move to report Senate Bill 133 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Senate Bill 133 moves from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. Okay. Senate Bill 151, decoupling from federal tax deduction. Are you our guest today? Okay. And this is our, I believe this is our second hearing?
Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Chuck Harlemert, and yes, Madam Chairwoman, this is your second hearing.
Okay, go ahead. Thank you.
Your third, actually.
Did you have any answers, any new information, or are you here for questions only?
I'm just here for questions. I think we've covered both sides of the issue.
Are there any questions for the Department of Revenue or Chuck? I had some question about the... just a minute. Wait for these. I knew there was something we were supposed to do with the fiscal note. And Chuck, if you could talk to us about the, I think we have a revised fiscal note.
That is correct, Madam Chairman.
So if you could do that, please. And
sure.
That would be the one, 419?
That is correct.
Okay, if you'll refer to a fiscal note of 419. Go ahead, please.
Okay. The only change in this fiscal note is that we put the...
Speak up.
I'm sorry. The only change in this fiscal note is that we put the median fiscal impact on the front page in revenues. That in fiscal year 06, we'll see about an 8.2 increment. Fiscal year 07, 9.4. Those numbers vary. In 2011, when it peaks at just over $15 million.
$15 million.
Yeah.
This is a good thing for the state budget.
This is revenue that we, that as of the close of last session, was heading our way. And when we allowed this year, it was not heading our way. So we're reinstating it, yes.
This restores.
Restores, yes.
Are there any questions about Senate Bill 151 that anyone would like to? Okay, I don't know that we have anyone else signed up to testify on that. No, we don't. And everyone recalls what this is? Is there any objection to us? Does anyone need further discussion on this, further review? Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, I move to report Senate Bill 151 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Objection? Senate Bill 151 moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Thank you, Chuck.
Thank you.
And now our final one for this morning, Senate Bill 71, the bill that impacts... compensation of certain public officials, officers, and employees not covered by collective bargaining units. Mike, are you joining us today? Okay. Okay. Can you get online? Thank you, Mike, for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning. For the record, Mike Tibbles with the Department of Administration, here to testify in support of Senate Bill 71. Senate Bill 71 matches the statutory pay schedule for partially exempt and exempt employees in the executive, legislative, and judicial branches with the recently negotiated salary schedules in the union contracts. It's that simple. Although, if the bill doesn't pass, the issues that we'll be faced with are much more complicated. But let me touch on three things real briefly, if I could, this morning. First of all, as a matter of process, to adjust the make a wage adjustment in the salary schedules for state employees, it's a two-step process. First of all, for covered employees, we negotiate through collective bargaining and submit the monetary terms to the legislature, and we've done that. For the partially exempt and exempt employees, we're required to submit a bill and update the statute, and that's what we have here in front of us. Because it's a two-step process, historically, both of them haven't always moved forward. So what we're seeing now is a disparity between the two schedules of about 5%. And that causes us concern, and it will grow throughout the 06 and 07 implementation of the contracts. If the schedules do not get matched up, I believe there's three real issues that I'd like to raise this morning. First one is an equity issue. We classify all of our state positions, and we assign salary ranges for those every state position based on a number of factors, include the nature and complexity of work, the amount of supervisory oversight, and the amount of supervisory requirements for that position, and that in statute even is a requirement that we pay based on like pay for like work. And so when we look at the nature and complexity of a position, and we compare it internally with another position, and say, what is the nature and complexity of that position, and then we assign salary ranges in the classification system. Getting back to the equity issue, that statutory mandate of paying like pay for like work, I don't believe we can meet that when we get to a 9% difference between the two salary schedules. We've had instances where we've tried to move a position even laterally to the same range. For example, a fiscal analyst from a department into OMB, and it's such a decrease in pay that the employee is not interested. So that has become a real problem. The other two issues I touch on briefly. One is recruitment. When we get to a point where there's such a large disparity between the schedules, it becomes a real problem with recruiting professionals, and we're asking our managers and directors to do more. If the bill doesn't pass, I believe it sends a message that we're not respecting the management that they do perform when, in many cases, individuals that were working under them can make more money than them when you get to a 9%. And the last point I'd like to bring to the committee's attention is that I believe when you get to such a large disparity between the two different schedules, it creates a problem encouraging people to move up. We also have a requirement to encourage career progression, and I don't believe that we're able to meet that when it doesn't take that many years and merit steps to be applied before individuals, I'll say supervisors, make more money than the supervisors of the supervisors. Mm-hmm. So when we get to, and you can look, I handed out a chart to the committee. If you look at the last page here, you can see the example. It shows by the fourth year, in a particular supervisor is making more than the incoming supervisor of the supervisor. Mm-hmm. That creates a real problem for us to get people to move up into management positions. So between the equity, the recruitment, and the upward progression, the difficulty in upward progression, I feel this bill is very important. Make sure that we have a better playing field. The union contracts have been submitted to the legislature, and those are moving forward in the budget process, and would hope that we'd have the committee support to adjust the statutory schedules as well.
Are there questions about the salary schedule and the dilemma? Senator Huffman.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. When was the last time that the salaries were adjusted, particularly for the Alaska court system?
Through the Chair, Senator Huffman. Chris Christensen is here to answer any specific more detailed questions than I can, but on the second page of this chart, it will show you a historical perspective for all the contracts, partially exempt, exempt, and the court system. That second column, XJ, is the court system. It will show a 2% increase in 01 and a 3% in 02. That was the last adjustment to the statutory schedule that applied to the court system, as well as partially exempt and exempts.
So, just so that everyone listening in understands, if an employee gets to the top of their range 10, and they're at step E or F, and they're encouraged to be promoted to a 12 or 13 or up to something, or say the next level, then they would actually lose money by being promoted in the current system. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is certainly possible. If they move from a classified position to a non-classified position, they'd be moving from a schedule that's been negotiated through collective bargaining that is higher than the schedule that exists in statute. So it certainly is possible when you move from covered to non-covered, you could be paid on a salary schedule that would pay you less than what you're currently making.
Okay. And so that presents a dilemma because you don't stay in the same step you're currently in. You go back to the front of the line in step A or an earlier step. Is that correct?
Well, Madam Chair, we have there's certain rules that govern advanced step placement.
Okay.
And I can't speak to the legislature's rules on how you place steps. But we have operating procedures in the executive branch where you can't move into longevity and you have to meet certain criteria before you can be placed within advanced steps.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly based on exceptional service and
But this certainly makes the smoothing much easier and draws it into line with what their counterparts in other part of state government are making, and that's sort of been a natural something that maybe that was overlooked or intentional in years past to. For various reasons, but this corrects all of those efforts in the past and makes it even, equal, and there's parity among like members in various agencies, departments, and legislative staff particularly, and I think courts and the ones involved. I notice that we also have Chris Christensen, who signed up. You may stay there, Mike, in case anyone else has a question. Chris, did you want to come and testify, please? Go ahead, Chris. Chris, before we get started, I do want you to notice we have a couple of extra co-chairs today. Connor and Noel Leaf are visiting here today, and they're my grandsons from Plenai. So it's been great to have them here, and you're helping us oversee Senate Finance today. Welcome, gentlemen. Glad to have you here. Thank you. Okay. Chris, would you go ahead and begin your testimony?
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Chris Christensen. I'm the Deputy Administrative Director of the Alaska Court System. I'd like to first thank Governor Murkowski for placing court employees in this legislation. First, a little bit of background. We have about 733 permanent employees. 62 are judges appointed by the governor. 39 are magistrates, and most of the rest are clerical employees. We absorb less than 2% of the state's operating budget, which makes us smaller than a number of departments in the executive branch. And while we're very small, more private citizens come through our doors every day than any other entity in state government, other than perhaps the university. Most of these people are angry or scared. They're going through the most traumatic experience of their lives, and they don't know how the system works. These are the people that our employees deal with every day. These people were involved in over 150,000 new cases filed last year. Court employees work hard under very stressful conditions. However, I've often heard from employees that they're proud of the work that they do. They believe that what they do matters, and most of them do it for a very low salary. Fully 70% of our employees are range 15 or below. Low salaries result in a very high turnover rate, which causes us management issues. Our turnover rate right now among clerical employees is about 50% before 5 years have passed. In rural Alaska, we have court locations such as Kotzebue where we can expect 100% turnover within 5 years. We have had as much as 100% turnover in 1 year. And this is because the many of the local corporations and the local boroughs pay substantially more than the state does for this kind of work. The legislature has historically given non-judicial court employees a cost of living adjustment equal to the COLA that it's provided to the union employees. The last time it failed to do that was in 1993. Shortly thereafter, non-supervisory court employees voted to join the IBEW. In 1996, the legislature gave both union and non-union employees a COLA that restored parity with the union contracts in the executive branch. Our unionized employees subsequently voted to decertify the IBEW as soon as the first collective bargaining agreement had expired. Now, workers organized for different reasons. For court employees, the main driver did not seem to be working conditions. It seemed to be pay equity with the union employees in the executive branch. Right now, I believe we have the largest non-union shop in state government. Now, with respect to our judges, salaries were ranked first in the nation back in 1982. Today, however, according to the National Center of State Courts, the salary of a Superior Court judge in Alaska ranks 49th once adjusted for cost of living. So from number one to number 49 in a little over 20 years. Normally when we talk about the state that's 49th in something, we're talking about Mississippi or Arkansas. In this case, we're talking about Alaska. The average annual increase for Superior Court judges in other states during the period from 1992 to 2004 was 3.1%. In Alaska, it averaged under 1%, which was well under half the rate of inflation. Madam Chair, unlike other state employees, judges do not get annual longevity increases. The salary of a new judge is exactly the same as the salary of a judge with 15 years of experience. So there are no longevity increases to help make up for missed cost of living adjustments. In addition, the geographic differential provided to rural judges is generally much, much less than that received by other state employees. For example, in Barrow, a union employee gets a 43% geographic differential, a non-union employee gets a 31.5% geographic differential, and the local Superior Court judge gets a 17% differential. Moreover, the judge's differential is calculated only on the first $40,000 of his or her salary. Other state employees have it calculated on their entire salary. So because of this lack of longevity increases and this lack of a very limited geographic differential, we're in a situation where there are places in rural Alaska where the local prosecutor or the local public defender actually makes more than the local Superior Court judge. Now, SB 71 would give the non-judicial employees of the court system a salary adjustment in FY06 that would place our salary schedule approximately on par with the salary schedule approved by the legislature last year for members of the APEA. Even if they get this, court employees will still have lost substantial ground to inflation over the last two decades. Judges will get a salary increase equal to the percentage increase that SB 71 proposes for a range 28E in the executive branch. There are statutes that tie a judge's, that say that a judge is supposed to get the same increase that a 28E on the salary schedule gets. Now, with this increase, Alaska's judges would jump from 49th in the nation to 47th. So it's probably not enough to qualify this as no judge left behind legislation, but it would still be sincerely appreciated. Madam Chair, the bill does send a message that the legislature values court employees as much as it values the union employees in the executive branch, that it doesn't take their hard work for granted. We thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. So you think this is a good thing for our employees?
Yes, Madam Chair, we do.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Are there any other questions? Art Chance, I notice your name is on here for questions. You have no testimony? Okay. Want to be sure? Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else who wish to testify on this legislation? Oh, okay. Pam. Very good. Come on up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Pam Varney. I'm Executive Director of the Legislative Affairs Agency. In the 1980s and again in the 90s, the executive branch received a raise which legislative employees did not. Currently, legislative employees lag roughly 5% behind their counterparts in the executive and judicial branches, with the exception of partially exempt employees. This bill should be passed as a matter of fairness and to eliminate any suggestion that employees doing similar work are not paid equally. It is long overdue. You want to retain the best and the brightest employees. We have lost many employees to the executive branch because they can take a position at the same range and step and make more money. Or they accept positions at a higher range and receive an additional 5% increase in pay. We need to stay on an even par to retain attorneys, programmers, personal assistants. And probably most important to each and every one of you are the staff working directly for you. It is interesting to note the drain of legislative assistance. In budgeting, I do not see the higher longevity steps that we used to have in the legislative branch. Also, we have had difficulty over the years in rural areas hiring our teleconference moderators. The private sector wages are higher, and we have trouble competing to attract people to come and work for us. It is difficult for our staff at the lower ranges to keep up with the cost of living. To give you some idea of the difference between the cost of living increases and our legislative pay increases, the CPIU increased from 1988 to 2003, which is 15 years, a total of 49.8%. Legislative pay increased 14.72%. We are 35.08% lower than the CPIU. It is a significant difference. To give you some comparisons to other state legislatures on how their salaries have changed over the last 5 years, New Mexico increased 14.5%. Louisiana increased 30%. Indiana increased 12.7%. Virginia increased 11.8%. Rhode Island increased 12.3%. And Alaska increased 5%. Thank you for your time, and as a manager and previous personnel officer, I urge you to pass this bill to make it fair and equitable to all employees in the legislative branch. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Pam? Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Are there any further questions about Senate Bill 71? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? Gentlemen.
Could I?
Sure, go ahead.
Where's Mike? What if Mike could come back?
Okay, Mike.
Mike, there's been general discussion over the years about, and I think every governor, regardless of the party, has struggled to find folks at the commissioner level to serve as commissioners. So what we have is extended searches, and then we have people that their financial means can meet with their duty for public service. And it just seems to bubble up every election cycle, and I think we've all heard it. Would this be the bill that we would address commissioner salaries? First question, I have another question.
Madam Chair, Senator Wilkin, commissioner salaries are somewhat of a unique situation because they're tied to a range and a step. And so that creates a problem where they are frozen, and as other employees are moving up, they end up making more money than their supervisor and the commissioner. The people come to serve the state of Alaska for a number of different reasons, mm-hmm. and some people are financially able, you know, take a lot larger cut from their previous professions than others. But I think generally that, you know, we have a concern that really came to light recently, where we were looking at three actually acting commissioners this session, and I can tell you from the applicant pool for those commissioner spots, there were a number of applicants that would have taken a pay cut from their current job to take those positions moving up. And so,
you mean they were state employees?
Yes.
At the time, and they took a cut to mm-hmm. become a commissioner?
They would have, a number of the applicant pools, Madam Chair, applicants in the applicant pool were state employees and would have taken a cut to move up.
Senator Wilkin.
I don't know what your intentions on the bill are, Madam Chair, whether we need to rush it along, but I don't know if this is the time to address that. And I guess what I'm thinking is this bill may at least take a step towards making it easier for the next governor, and even if we put in a commissioner's salary adjustment with a four-year delayed effective date or something like that, that wouldn't benefit current ones, but it would certainly make it easier for the next governor or governors to at least make that problem a little less little less of a problem as they try to staff those important positions. So just offered up as a thought more than anything.
Thank you. Yeah, and another thing, maybe just releasing it from the set amount in statute and tying it to a range and step. Go ahead, Mike.
Madam Chair, a simple amendment would be to remove the E designation. And to remove the E designation on the 28E for commissioners, the statute could still mandate that they're paid at a range 28. However, they would be allowed to move up the steps similar to every other employee.
Is the 28E designation, is that frozen at a 28E when that was originally put in the statute, or does it float and go up every time there is a salary adjustment statewide?
Madam Chair, it would move up with the statutory schedule. So
it does it now move up?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. Senator Dyson, did I see your hand up? No? Okay. Oh, okay. Well, we'll work on this and be back with it and talk about it and see if there are any other ideas or amendments that people have and want to ask some questions. Maybe you might be expecting some phone calls or make some visits to see if there are any questions or concerns that we need to address and hopefully get this finished and on its way very quickly. Thank you, Mike. Is there any other business to come before the committee this morning? And I did want to announce that Cindy Bundy is excused and will be Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. And my wife and Lucky's wife, Kathy, have joined us to kind of get an idea what their husbands do on these 9 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. And, welcome.
Delighted that
good to have
here.
You here. Thank you. Thank you. Glad they're here.
You want to sit up to the front?
You want your picture taken? Okay. Thank you. I think that is all that we have on our agenda for this morning. Senator Wilkin, do you have any comments?
Yeah,
okay.
Thank you.
Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., Senator Wilkin will have a presentation on Senate Bill 171, NPRA Community Grant Program, and Senate Bill 174 will take up Senate Bill 174, exempt U-Hauls from vehicle rental tax. Any changes to the schedule will be posted by 4 p.m. since we're now under the 24-hour rule. Okay. Anything else to come before the committee? We are adjourned.
I thought yesterday about 4 o'clock or so.